Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. At some point in everyone's life, some object catches their fancy. Maybe it was baseball cards or toy soldiers, maybe coins or postage stamps, marbles or dolls. If you're a Louisiana Eats listener, odds are good that your collection may involve food, whether it's cooking it, serving it, or just researching it. Well, hold on to your hat, because this week we're taking culinary collecting to a whole new level. Patrick Dunn curates a world-class collection of kitchen and tabletop antiques at his French Quarter Emporium, Lucullus. We'll get a personal tour of his treasure trove, and then we visit with Philippe Lamancusa, whose personal cookbook collection got so out of hand that he opened a magical shop called Kitchen Witch. But when it comes to a collection getting out of hand, Ed Piglia takes first place. We'll take you with us to Ed's huge Kenner warehouse display, where collecting literally has no bounds. This week's Louisiana Eats should come with a warning label. Ready, set, prepare to collect.
I'm Patrick Dunn. I'm the proprietor of Lucullus Antiques on Charter Street.
When visitors step into Patrick Dunn's French Quarter shop, they discover a treasure trove of 17th, 18th, and 19th century tabletop and kitchen antiquities. They'll also find collectors keen on unearthing a one-of-a-kind piece to take home with them. To get a better sense of the mindset of a collector, Louisiana Eats visited Lucullus to get Patrick's take on the world of collecting and have a glimpse at some of his rare and unique offerings. Patrick began by explaining what he believes is the difference between a collector and a dealer.
I'm not a collector. I don't think antique dealers can be good antique dealers and collectors at the same time. I like to display the stuff, but I really love to sell it. So I guess I'm really more of an Irish horse trader at heart. Collecting is actually a extremely interesting topic for me. I'm actually the son of a collector. As a child, I followed my father around, and he was an inveterate auction goer. He started out by trying to take back and collect things that had belonged to his family and had been dispersed. And I sat through many a hot Southern afternoon at auction houses. And I think I developed an extreme distaste for that because, unlike he who could walk away and not win, I couldn't stand not to get what I wanted. Collectors really come in lots of different ilks. Some people collect a little bit of everything. Some people collect one thing but do it vertically, getting better and better, rare, rare, rare. And then some people collect in series. And to tell you the truth, we've had all of these types in here. One of my favorite attributes of collectors is this overwhelming sense of guilt. Really inveterate collectors feel like it is a little bit of an addiction. And they swear to themselves that if they just buy this one more thing, they'll never do it again. And one of my favorite experiences were an adorable client that I've had for many, many years who lives in Yazoo City. She had come in and she said, "I'm not buying anything, I'm just looking." and she would end up buying several things. And when I'd wave goodbye to her in her car, she'd have tears streaming down her face. And she says, I did it again, I did it again.
Collections can be big and small, both in scale and quantity. Tell me about some collections you've seen.
Everybody has their own passions. One of our dearest clients, is somebody I can just divulge, is John Foltz. And he cannot resist mechanical tools. He has a number of tourne brushes, which are things that you can roast in front of a fireplace. And he loves copper. And he only loves copper on mammoth scales. And he has one of the best collections ever of cooking copper, but of extraordinary size. One of our clients for the last 30 years who lives in Texas collects any kind of odd article for the kitchen. She probably has 1,000 pieces. Pie crust cutters, mechanical things, chocolate cutters, sugar smashers. That was one of the biggest collections that I've seen of small, odd objects. She's not at all interested in a beautiful 18th century dining table. She wants some very unusual kitchen article that you have to really worry about what it was used for.
Well, Patrick, after all, unless you have many houses, what are you going to do with many beautiful 18th century dining tables?
It's not what you're going to do with them. It's the pleasure of having them.
I have a little bit of a sterling silver problem myself.
And I, too, love silver. And when I was going off to college, I had an adorable grandmother who ruled my life. And I'll never forget, she was packing my trunk, and she put in a little box, and it was silver, a couple of silver forks, a couple of silver spoons, and a knife. She said, promise me one thing. Promise me you'll never go down to that dining hall without using these silver forks. She said, other metals will ruin your teeth. So I went to Georgetown, and this was in the ancient days, and I'd slip the fork and spoon in my pocket and go down and eat with it. But of course I got found out, and you can imagine how much ribbing one got for not using stainless steel.
How do you prepare for a life such as yours, other than having a daddy who takes you to auctions all over the place?
There was no preparation for a life like this. I should have been a field hand, because that's what being an antique dealer is. It's unremitting labor, and often very disheartening, because we're going through a period where people don't really love old things, which I think is a shame. After almost 35 years, it's a ground scratching. And I think, like all wonderful things in life, part of it is knowledge, but a large part is luck. And I spend quite a bit of time in Europe, and my ear is always to the ground. And I think I never do stop working. I go out to the country almost every weekend. Sometimes I'll be driving through some little country town and see a store and stop, and you can always find something that's interesting and something that's beautiful.
Out of all the things that you have acquired and sold or kept over time, what do you think is the rarest and most unusual thing for the dining room or the kitchen that you came across?
There are two things that I regret probably selling. One was a first century BC Greek pottery cup that was a wine cup, two-handled wine cup, that I had bought from a collector in the south of France whose grandfather had gotten them in Sicily. It was a beautiful, very dark green, black almost, wine cup. And it was so ancient and so simple.
What was it made from?
Pottery.
Ah.
It was a crator, what they call a crator, with two great handles, and it was in perfect condition. You see them in museums, but you almost never see them. The other thing, which now would be profoundly illegal, was something I bought from a friend's aunt in England whose grandfather had been in India, and it was a carving set whose handles were made from elephant tusks, and they were gigantic. They were as tall as you are.
Patrick, would you take us on a tour of your beautiful shop and point out some of the fabulous things that people come to you to collect?
One thing in serious and fun antique shops, which I hope we're both, because one of the things I try to make this shop is as playful as well as being very serious about what I do, is you need to open all the doors and all the drawers. And behind this armoire door is a huge stacks of old French linen. One of the things I really do love to collect, and these are true dinner napkins. Poppy, you can see the scale of these napkins, which could cover any lady's silk hoop skirt. I always try to find very large, lengthy tablecloths that fit on banquet cloths and big series. And we keep track of all the initials.
I have antique table linens, and there's nothing that I love like using my gorgeous, enormous napkins at a dinner. But I find that people are afraid of these things now. There's no reason to fear them.
Well, there's nothing that I sell that's just for looking. I want everything to be used. Part of the fun of a dinner party, even if you only have it once every 6 months, is to enjoy using. These are not sacred relics. These things are charming objects to be used and really enjoyed.
In this case?
Okay, well, this case is full of our best and prettiest silver. And it's not that these things are terrifically elaborate. It's just that they're extremely good old silver and charming.
It's so important to realize that everything doesn't have to match in anyone's home.
No, and that's the fun of it. I have always said that part of our look is, if you would, the ancestral look, which was accumulating many different things over many different periods, which is what families did.
Patrick, if I were to come into Lucullus and say, show me the rarest, most unusual thing you have today, where would we go?
To ask me that question is like to ask me what my favorite color is or what my favorite piece of music is. It's really, I can't do it because... For me, each of these pieces is rare and precious, honestly. The fact that it survived, the fact that it was cared for, imbues it with a certain magic, way, way beyond nostalgia, that for generations, things were valued for the effort that human imagination and human effort put into them. I couldn't pick one thing out. If you told me that I could only save one thing and I had run out of the store with it, I couldn't think of what it would be.
Patrick Dunn, proprietor of Lucullus Antiques in New Orleans, French Quarter. When we return from a short break, we'll explore the world of cookbook collecting with Philippe Lamancusa of The Kitchen Witch. Stay tuned. In the dawn. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. Knowledge is power, and for food lovers, there's no tool more powerful than a cookbook. That's the first thing that Philippe Lamancusa learned when he began to carve a place for himself in the restaurant industry back in the 60s. Philippe became an obsessive cookbook collector as his culinary career transported him from New Orleans to the West Coast and back again. By that time, he had thousands of cookbooks in his personal collection. And that's when he opened Kitchen Witch, a shop of books for cooks. Originally located in the French Quarter, now in the 7th Ward, Philippe and his partner, Debbie Lindsay, have found a home for their books in a space covered in culinary treasures and illuminated by endless twinkling lights. Producer Sarah Holtz visited Philippe and Debbie at Kitchen Witch and came back with much more than a good recipe.
There's no such thing as a bad cookbook. There'll be a book here for 8 years and somebody will walk in and it'll be just the book they're looking for.
Hi, I'm Debbie Lindsay, co-owner of Kitchen Witch, and this is my partner.
Philippe Lamancusa. Yes, I'm the other co-owner. Kitchen Witch, cookbooks, music, and art. You know, I was working in San Francisco, and one day I came home, and my daughter was living with me, and she had seen me buying cookbooks, and daughters learn how to roll their eyes at a certain point. She would roll her eyes, and I would say, when I retire, I'm going to open a cookbook store. And we always talked about our time in New Orleans. We're living in San Francisco, and one day I'm doing the big wah-wah about, you know, it's been, you know, 10 weeks without a day off. It's been 14-hour days. I'm planning another menu. I'm writing the recipes. I'm hiring staff. I don't know who I am. I have nothing in common with myself. And she just said, you know, look at the hand. Stop. It's time for you to retire. It's time for you to open up your cookbook store. And it's time to go back to New Orleans. So she came back and we opened the cookbook store
and
on Rampart Street.
And now we work 7 days a week.
It's like I had 5,000 cookbooks that I had collected because as a chef, I needed to know. And that was when, 1972. Still, there's so much more to learn. And still I'm collecting cookbooks. And still we're selling cookbooks now. And then we collect more cookbooks. And you know, at home, we have shelves and shelves of books as well. It's just like we're book people. We just love collecting books.
Except when we opened, I contributed one book. One book. He contributed 5,000.
But it's okay because I cook.
Yeah, and then I explain, all right, 42 years experience working in restaurants, front of the house, 50 years experience working, definitely kitchen, back of the house.
It was functional because it was part of my education and part of the teaching of my staff. That I had one job for 8 years that I was able to do whatever I wanted to. And so I could plan a calendar and then I would walk in to my staff on Friday and say, this weekend we're doing Basque food. And then the next week say, oh, we're doing food from Spain. Okay, now we're doing Thai food this weekend, and did that for 8 years. And so I would go out and I would absorb everything I could on, if we were doing Mexican food, I would go down to the Mexican section of San Francisco, and I would, if I was going to do tamales, I would spend a day eating tamales in every restaurant I could, and then get every book I could that included tamales, and learn to make tamales.
I always pimp him out, especially when we sell Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen. So people would come in, they'd almost like they rehearsed it. If I were to get just one, I know what you're going to say, just one book from Louisiana, this is it. And I walk him over, as he does too, to Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen, his first, his best. And I explain to the people from somewhere that's never seen them, you know, think Julia Child, fat with a beard. You got Paul Prudhomme. So anyway, then I show them Philippe's beat up copy from 1985 that he's chefed out of. And even though I don't cook, well, I can sell it with such confidence because I can see all the years of knowledge that he's acquired from it. So with each book, and we'll do it for any of them if you want, but with this one in particular, we stick our business card, a little crack and peel label, inside, and I tell them, you have your very own complimentary culinary consultant via phone or email. All you got to do is call this dude up and you've got your support line, your help line. Surprise, surprise. Hi, how are y'all?
Hello, Kitchen Witch.
I was here years ago, but when you were in a different location.
Water, yes.
And so I was like, I have to go to Kitchen Witch.
Oh,
so we looked
thank
it
you.
Up and we're hurrying.
You know, you get a book, and like we got Joy of Cooking, which was published in 1931, done by Irma S. Rombauer. We have an autographed copy. I mean, it's like, it's priceless. You know, the first edition of Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Priceless. It's here. It's for sale. And if I don't sell it, I don't care. I've got it. It's mine. Books we have sold. We have a first edition of first English translation of the work of Apicius. Recipes date from the 1st to 3rd century B.C. First English translation, 1936, only 530 copies printed. The last one we sold went to Rome to the man that was the organizer of Slow Food. It was bought by some of his people to take to him as a present. I hated to lose it, but, you know, yeah. What Debbie's told me is that that's the business. But what I've realized is when I sell a cookbook, I can buy another one. It's an addiction. The Paul Prudhomme that I have, that's mine, was signed to me by him. And it's like, he's not signing anymore. And I'm not giving that one away. That one's not for sale. I got it in it was at the World's Fair in 1984. We had gone to eat dinner there. I got the book and I had him sign it to me. And then I took it back to California where I was working. And I started working the recipes. And I thought, this is some hot stuff.
Don't let me down.
At home, we collect things. We, you know, whenever, like, we see in the store, they have little statues of Our Lady of Guadalupe, we buy 10. We couldn't dissolve this life that we have. We have 10,000 cookbooks. I used to collect shoes, but I don't do that anymore. Used to collect hats too.
What happened to the shoes?
I just didn't have room for them. Having 20 or 30 pairs of shoes is a wonderful thing because you never know how your feet are going to feel in the morning. Engineering books.
This?
$4.
$4.
Sold.
It's a Creole cookbook. It predates, Lafcadio Hearn was 1865. He wrote a Creole cookbook. But there was one written in 1892 by a woman named Virginia James. In 1892, this book sold for $3. As opposed to in 1900, the Picayune Creole cookbook only sold for $1. This was a book probably for women to read to their servants. The cooks in those kitchens, they were up from slavery. And in probably 1892, when the book was written, the kitchen was full of ex-slaves. I don't really want to sell it, but it's for sale.
What don't you want to sell?
The
1892? Oh, no, baby, you sell anything we can sell. I'll sell you for a good price.
Church cookbooks. There's church cookbooks from all over the country here. But would we turn one down? No. Can't turn them down. They're books, you know, they're written. You just go through them and you find out people's lives.
Philippe LaMancusa and Debbie Lindsay, owners of Kitchen Witch Cookbook. heart of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum is La Galerie de Absinthe, an exhibit that showcases vintage absinthe bottles, spoons, fountains, and other accoutrements that surround the world of the elusive Green Fairy. This extensive collection is owned entirely by two brothers, Ray and B.J. Bordelon, whose interest in absinthe's history and collectibles became an obsession. The Bordelons joined us in our SOFAP studio to talk about their avocation for absinthe and give us a closer look at some of the rarest articles in their exhibit.
My name is Ray Bordelon, and my passion is absinthe.
And I'm B.J. Bordelon, and since 2004, it has also been my passion.
Well, for me, the absinthe journey started with a small antique store on Magazine Street with an absinthe spoon. I had always been a big collector of Victorian silver pieces. The Victorians had a serving piece for everything. It was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, a lemon fork, an oyster fork, a lettuce fork, ice cream fork, just something for everything. And when I saw this absinthe spoon with the holes in it, it was like, what is this used for? Is this the Victorian piece I've overlooked? What's the deal? And I started digging into it to find out it was for this drink. And the history of the drink started questioning, where is it? How is it? Where can you get it? What's it about? Finding out it's illegal, that makes you a little more enticing as to where can I get it? What's more about it? And it all led to this liquor that was very misunderstood and got a bad rap. But this spoon piqued my interest, and that opened the floodgates.
And what year was this?
This was about year 2000, most probably.
So back in the year 2000, absinthe was still illegal.
Yes.
So when was the first time that you actually got to taste absinthe?
Well, I had connections with people, some cloak and dagger things of meeting some people in the alley behind St. Louis Cathedral at midnight to buy some contraband absinthe from Europe and things like that.
Are you exaggerating?
No, I'm not. So there were little incidents like that, but I tasted some that was in the works right before it was legalized. There was one bar in particular that was serving absinthe that's in our museum now that they would light a green lantern in the window at night after 7 o'clock. And if the lantern was lit, they were serving absinthe. But you had to know the bartender and you had to kind of be on the end with them. And they would pour you an absinthe from the makeshift fountain and you might be sitting next to a policeman drinking a cup of coffee. But they would serve you absinthe, and it was illegal at the time. But they were getting it from Europe and from different places, contraband, so to speak.
Oh, there is something very titillating about something illegal. B.J., you're 4 years later to the party. Your brother is already in total enthrall with his obsession.
Yep.
How do you catch it?
Well, 2004, we went on a trip to Montreux, Switzerland, stayed for a week at the Montreux Palace on Lake Geneva. And by hook or by crook, my brother ends up finding two bottles of Kubler 53 absinthe in Old Town, Switzerland, and brings them back to the room. And every afternoon, we would sit on the veranda overlooking Lake Geneva in the Swiss Alps and have a couple of absinthes. And began talking about the history, which it is truly history in a bottle. And by the time the week was over and I guess it was in May. By December, he gave me my first absinthe saucer, glass, and spoon, and it was game over. I was totally in.
So you get that first spoon. How does the collection grow into, do you know how many pieces of absinthe, memorabilia, accessories?
I'll put it like this right now. I'll give you a little example. What we have in the museum is part. Right now, the underside of my bed is completely filled with absinthe glasses that we did not have room for in the museum.
My goodness. So there's you have your own museum at home, too.
Basically, yes. And my brother has the same at his house, I think.
Yep.
Do y'all ever quarrel over who gets a piece? Or
no.
Is it sort of finders, keepers?
We've kind of had, I guess, a gentleman's agreement. A lot of the sources where we get our items, if I find out that he is watching something on an auction, I'll usually defray away from it.
Or
the same thing with
him. We both want something, we'll settle on it and either bid it and share it, or if there's something that's two, we'll go in half and you buy one and I buy one.
Yeah. So we'll decide what is your maximum bid, and whoever has the highest the other one would just bow out because they weren't going to bid that much anyway.
But what a great fun game for two grown-up brothers to play.
It's kind of like a game, but it's also trying to gather as much history and information, and that is the whole purpose of the museum, is to share with the public the history of this drink.
And it's always been for the cause.
For the cause. And it's all, like we say, for the cause, because we get nothing out of it monetary. I mean, but it's so much fun to meet people and to put the correct history forth rather than all this, that it's not the villain it was made out to be. It had its own life going on. And as you walk through the museum, you're going to see examples of it was in art, it was in literature, it was in music. So it permeated society. It wasn't just a drink to go get drunk in an alley and fall out. It inspired and it was part of the culture at the time.
So now, for the cause, could we please have a tour?
Please
do. Okay.
Absolutely. Down below here, something curious you're going to see. This is a woman's fan, and it's made, if you look at it, it's rats.
It's rats?
It's rats. It's the cutouts are little rats' heads with the ears. If you see the eyes, see the little dots? Those are the eyes.
Oh, I see it
and
now.
And the tails are curled at the end. It's from a place in Paris called Au Rat Mort, is what that plate shows. And it was a big hangout for absinthe drinkers at the turn of the century for lots of these poets. And that's the name of it. It was called Au Rat Mort.
The dead rat.
The dead rat, exactly. So that's just a few little things. There's a postcard of its picture there. But most of these things you see are all to do with the service of absinthe. The topettes here, the little ringed vials here. This was used when a waiter would come to your table, rather than put a whole bottle on the table and then you drink out of it and then try to figure how much did they drink, they would fill this topette with absinthe. Then you would pour. Each ring is one dose or one jigger, so to speak. So you could use this, and when they would come in to charge you, they would know how many doses you drank by what was used out of the bottle, rather than put a whole bottle on the table. Likewise, the saucers you see, or soucoupes as they call them, or tip trays, you can see they have the prices on them. All the drinks came with their price on the saucer, and they would leave those on the table. So the waiter would come to your table and total up your saucers to know what you had drank and how many.
It's like eating dim sum.
And they came with this, and the reason for the saucers was to keep your clothes from being soiled in case the drink dripped or was sweating. And a lot of them were color-coded. Different restaurants had color coding, so if you knew a drink was 2 francs, it was a purple one, or if it was this color, that. And the same thing with the perogene, or a match strike. They contained a lot of advertisement for absinthe companies and all drinks. So nothing's new. Everyone wanted their name out there on everything that was being served in the bars.
And what is the name of the sugar dishes? Because everything
they
seems to have...
They call those a plateau. Plateau de sucre. And it was just they would put the sugar cubes on these plateaus to serve them to bring to the table for the people. And the difference in France and New Orleans, it seems to be from my research, is in France, you were preparing your own drink. Here in New Orleans, it seems like the bartender would fix the drink for you. Because you don't find very many, I don't know of any particular absinthe spoons local to New Orleans. They seem to favor more the drip. Here's absinthe and music. Here's Victor Herbert did a comic opera in 1904 called It Happened in Nordland. The big song in this thing was Absinthe Frappe. And that was the song that they said was contributed to absinthe being very popular in Louisiana and in the Western world here, because this catchy little ditty was on everybody's tongue because of the words, and it talks about an absinthe frappe. Here it is on a music box disc, which I have at the house, which plays, and it's wonderful. And here is it on a piano roll, absinthe frappe. Here it is on an Edison cylinder for Edison cylinder player. So it was in everything.
Ray and BJ Bordelon, absinthe collectors and enthusiasts. What was the favored form of fly catching in the 19th century? We'll answer that question when we come right back.
You can fly, you can fly, you can fly, you can fly.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally slow roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What was the favored form of fly catching in the 19th century? Flies have forever been the bane of the kitchen and dining room. Since the dawn of time, man has relentlessly tried to rid himself of the pests when preparing or eating food. There's the fly swatter. There's those disgusting sticky rolls you can find hanging in some commercial kitchens. And there's even that crazy penny in a Ziploc bag of water trick that many people claim to drive flies away. But leave it to the Victorians to make fly catching both beautiful and elegant. In dining rooms of the 1800s, it was common to find a beautiful blown glass or crystal contraption sitting on a sideboard, filled sometimes with sugar water, but many held a mixture of milk, water and arsenic, or mercury chloride. Often, the vessels had a cork on top, and the flies were lured in through a hole in the bottom, where they feasted on the poisoned liquid or simply deliriously drowned in the sugar water. By the 1880s, there were patented designs, and the fly catchers came in decorative colors of emerald green, amethyst purple, and ruby red. Want to see some of these amazing creations? Visit Patrick Dunn at Lucullus. Those beautiful antiques are still capable of catching 21st century flies. I'm Poppy Tooker. And you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
I remember your face when I think of this place. When I'm thinking back, I'll remember. When I'm far, far away, I remember today. When I'm thinking back, I won't forget you.
It's not unusual to have nostalgia for your childhood. But collector Ed Piglia has taken that idea to an entirely new level. For the past 30 years, Ed has been collecting New Orleans memorabilia of all kinds, centering in the mid-20th century. What began as a hobby now covers nearly every inch of an enormous warehouse that Ed maintains in Kenner. The Louisiana Eats crew spent an afternoon touring room after room of Ed's heirloom hideaway, where each turn brought another blast from the past.
I've had a fascination with things from that era ever since I was, I'd say a teenager. I've been collecting over 30 years, and the more I know, the more categories I start collecting.
So you begin this obsession of collecting as a teenager, huh?
Late teens, early 20s. My mother was a garage sale lady back in the 60s because she left my father and raised four of us by herself. And she actually went to garage sales for household items and clothing. And she'd pick up these beautiful pieces of furniture for nothing and redo them herself. And my sisters and I were a little too young to appreciate that, but when I moved out, I said, Mom, can I have that table? How about that old lamp and that clock? It became cool all of a sudden in my apartment. And then it just kind of grew. My passion grew. And it evolved into all of this.
You may be a million miles away. Please believe me, yeah. When you hear me.
So what were the first items that you started collecting?
I would say probably a couple of old lamps from my apartment and an old clock and some old chairs. And I didn't really get into the New Orleans, although, you know, I grew up, I was born and raised in New Orleans and always did have fond memories of the corner grocery store and the lunch counters at K&B and Schweighart drugstore. But I didn't start collecting those type of items probably until about 20 years ago. I'm in the bar and restaurant business, and I remember the neighborhood corner ballrooms. My dad was always in them. And the Regal and Dixie and Jack's beer items became of an interest to me. And then that that grew into food items and menus and swizzle sticks and anything New Orleans. I guess what I always promised myself is I would only collect things that I could display. I didn't want to collect things and put them in boxes and put it in the attic. I mean, my purpose was to be able to look at them every day, take a little stroll down memory lane whenever I wanted to. So the garage became full, and I promised my wife I wouldn't let any of that go into the house because the house is, believe it or not, it's the total opposite of this. It's hardly anything. It's very neat, clean, no clutter, minimalist at home. So it's duality of my personality, I guess. But so I bought this building with no intentions of doing this, and it just I moved everything from my garage here, and then it started filling up. And of course, I had higher ceilings, so I could buy bigger signs, and the collection grew.
Down on
well, most of the signs, I'm a sign rescuer, you know, self-appointed and self-titled, but the Wholesome Cafeteria sign was hanging on the guy's fence, a friend of mine, and they had taken it down. That was on Jefferson Highway near the Arrow Room, and the two sign was a double-sided neon in front of the cafeteria, and both pieces were hanging on his fence, and he, through a friend of mine, said, well, listen, he can have one, and I had the neon done on it and redid it. But most of the electric, the fluorescent signs, I have rescued and redid them myself, particularly like the old corner ballroom signs like this here, or you know, there's a few in the back. The K&B signs, I bought them from flea markets, estate sales, being in the right place at the right time.
Good heavens, it's after 11. But I must get a bottle of shampoo and some shaving cream, toothpaste and Band-Aids.
Incredible that you could still today have a milk carton in existence.
I've got quite a few of them. In fact, I've got a Mackenzie's milk carton in the back. We'll see later. But the Borden's and the Walker Roma Dairy used to be in Metairie, no longer there. Yeah, I don't know who saved them, but, you know, I've got an eye, and, of course, I feel like I have to rescue them.
Milk is available everywhere and to everybody at every season of the year.
Mrs. Drake's, now this is the most unusual thing. Who would save Mrs. Drake's labels from sandwiches?
Well, who did that?
A friend of mine did. He saved them from when he was a kid, and I guess he, you know, used his allowance of lunch money, and he decided to save these labels. And when he came to see my collection, he says, I've got something that you need to have. I don't know if there's any other ones in existence. I mean, these go back probably to the late 50s, early 60s. These, I remember these in the mid-60s, this particular label.
Well, Big Bopalula, she's my baby. Big Bopalula, I don't remember. Big Bopalula, she's my baby.
I was looking for your Dickie's potato chips. Remember Dickie's potato chips? I don't think they're around anymore.
No, they're not. This was the plant on Elysian Fields. And I've been looking for a Dickie's bag, which is going to be a tough, tough find.
Now, that's your current Holy
the
Grail?
5 cent, that's my Holy Grail. Now, that's the big search item. Well, one of the big search items. But I remember buying those for Nicola bag at school. And I remember the translucent plastic cellophane-y type bag and the colors. I still remember it vividly, but it's can't seem to find one. We'll go through here. I've got a little reference room, a library, and this is mostly toys in here. You may remember this sound from the streetcar. When you got on the streetcar, talk about sounds that bring you back.
Do that again.
I remember stepping on. This is if you came in with a transfer, if you paid cash.
How'd you catch that train, man? That's the train my baby's on.
Growing up in that time period, mid-60s, you know, on, but particularly 65, for some 65, 66, 67, we lived uptown on Spruce, went to Monte Della Rosa School, and we rode our bicycles everywhere, corner groceries, drug stores, the pet shop, you know, and it was just a great time.
Schweikarts must have been high on your list.
Schweikarts, we passed in front of Schweikarts walking home from school every day, and my sister, I had three sisters, and we would all pool our lunch money together. Whatever we saved, we didn't spend at lunch, and we'd save up and get a nectar soda, which we would split on the way home. Of course, I always drank more than my share, according to them.
Remember, your favorite snack will taste especially good with world-famous ice-cold Coca-Cola.
Each generation thinks that they grew up in the right generation at the time. You know, I mean, my mom said it to us. I say it to my daughter. She may say it to her children. I feel fortunate that I grew up in a time. It's, you know, social changes and just the freedoms that were, you know, women's lib and things that were happened. And a lot of my collection reflects that.
What's going to happen to all this stuff?
Well, I'm hoping when my time has come to pass it on, that we get enough people involved, and we've been talking about this in some of our sessions here at the warehouse with other collectors, to maybe get enough energy behind us to do a New Orleans Cultural Museum. I think it would be a fascinating place to visit. You know, to have K&B and Time Saver and all the things we grew up with on display. I think a lot of people would like to see that. I know when I bring people through here, they just are fascinated because we have all forgotten the little incidental things in our lives that we grew up with as kids, you know, candy and soft drinks and things. And when you come in here and you see it, it just really does take you back to a better place. I know it does for me.
That was Ed Piglia at his fantastical warehouse of collectibles in Kenner, Louisiana. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we sit down with famed Chicago chef, Rick Bayless.
I ate my first oyster here at Felix's and had my first fine dining meal at Antoine's and then the next morning brunch at Brennan's. And I was 13 and super interested in food. In fact, I was the one that planned all of those places to eat.
On Thursday, January 12th, Louisiana Eats is teaming up with French Market Coffee for the first in a series of celebrity chef dinners to benefit the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Join us for an evening of fun and fine dining as Brennan's executive chef, Slade Rushing, prepares a three-course meal with wines paired by Bin 428. To see the menu and buy tickets, visit my website, poppytooker.com. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.